敌人的飞机肯定会巡逻这一带，当务之急是先找地方躲起来，天黑再出发。雷公，撤！撤离火车！撤离火车！
2nd time I've had you on.
That's right.
And once again, I am putting you behind the paywall. But this time, I'm gonna put a larger chunk of this online. So I feel like you're my special treat that I have to hide away from the world. You have to pay $5 if you want to access this sweet, sweet content. But welcome back to the show, Fei Yang, friend of the podcast, patron of my podcast, very kind man. Do you want to introduce yourself for the people who may have missed your first bonus episode? And tell us a little bit about what you do and your interests.
Yeah, you know, nothing really that special, just someone who's really interested in Chinese politics, news, history. You know, my undergraduate studies were mostly about Imperial China, but, you know, since graduating, kind of branched out into more modern things as well. But, you know, really excited to be back on.
So thank you for coming on, and thank you for indulging me in this very strange you know, obsession I've had for like a week and a half now since watching this movie and kind of reading about it. So we're here today to talk about the battle at Lake Changjin. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's this new Chinese war, I guess, epic, I guess it could be described, or war action movie, kind of action movie, I guess the genre we should we'll talk about. But it came out like 2 months ago in China, or September 30th, and it's now basically been minted as the biggest box office hit in like Chinese history. It's made almost $1 billion. Yeah, it's got a huge sort of response. So we're here today to talk about that. But before we sort of get into the plot of it, because it does tell this really, kind of like, I mean, this word is cheap now because of the internet, but like a really epic story of the People's Volunteer Army, PVA, that was organized in response to the American sort of the Korean War, whatever. I mean, you're going to do a better job explaining it to me. But essentially, this is the kind of frame of the movie that we're talking about today. And it's a kind of, it explores multiple characters all around this battle, around this strategic lake that was very disastrous for the American. But can we at the outset talk a little bit about the historical kind of setting for this, of like Chinese involvement in the Korean War, and like, and why this is, because that, well, I think in some ways it has to, at least part of it, why it's struck such a chord. And this isn't the first movie about the Korean War too, obviously. There's been lots, and I read that there was one even in the 60s that was very influential, but maybe we can talk about that. But
so this movie is about one of the first major battles that the PVA fought with the UN forces, and it's, you know, it's not the first time that the UN forces fought the Chinese army. So there are actually a couple of engagements, like a couple of weeks or a month prior, but, you know, the Chinese army surprised the UN forces there because they didn't expect that China would be in North Korea. But, you know, although they took some defeats, they noticed that the PVA, like, didn't really follow up and just kind of, like, disappeared. So MacArthur felt like, okay, you know, they probably don't have that many forces in Korea. So they launched something called, like, the Home by Christmas Offensive, which, you know, they talk about at the beginning of the movie, too. But the idea is, like, you know, let's finish the job, let's take over the remaining pockets of North Korea that the UN forces haven't occupied yet. And, you know, they began advancing.
An advance airfield in Korea. United Nations observers spot disorganized communist units fleeing to the red border and beyond the 38th parallel. This is the saga of the unbeatable combination that swept behind enemy positions, cutting their communications and destroying military concentrations. Australian fighter planes and their fighting crews go into action, along with United States Air Force units doing a round-the-clock job of delivering death and destruction to communists vainly endeavoring to escape. This was the spearhead of our ground troops' swift advance. Another rain of rockets is backed up with inflammable jelly bombs. An ammunition dump is hit. This is the end of the battle for Seoul, capital of the Republic. The final job of mopping up snipers ends in victory. But the aftermath of the action for Seoul has a letdown. It's weary business chasing red bandits and liberating a country whose only wish is freedom from aggression. It also calls for sacrifice in lives and blood of Koreans and Americans who are grimly determined to stop communist imperialism. General MacArthur makes a personal visit to Seoul, where he returns the government of the Republic to President Syngman Rhee. With tears in his eyes, the Supreme Commander completes his first assignment under the United Nations banner. The drive on the 38th parallel continues. General MacArthur demanded complete surrender. But surrender or no surrender, these patriots will not rest until their country is free and unified.
So that's kind of where we lead up to this big battle. In English, it's known as like the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir, which is the name difference there is because the U.S. used Japanese maps, so they have the Japanese name for the area, which is Chosin, but the Chinese and Korean name is closer to Changjin, which is the name of this movie.
I mean, isn't it so telling that the imperialists used the imperial name for the place that they were invading? Like, of course you don't know the name of the place that you're invading. You just know it for your own. I mean, it's just such an evocative thing, the entire American project, you know, of just like, oh, whatever, this is all. I mean, really, the imperial history here is really fascinating, too, surrounding it of like, because preceding this part, this phase of the Korean War for Liberation, you had, what, 40, 50 years of Japanese colonial occupation? And maybe that's too much. But like a long time, decades at least, right?
Yes. So
it's like tens or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're getting into kind of the stakes of it because the importance of defending Korea from U.S. incursion, because essentially it was this crossing of the 38th parallel that triggered this crisis in the Chinese leadership, right? Of the early days of the PRC. Right, is like, well, we have to do something. Like, we have to, and this is depicted in the movie. I did have a question for you as like a watcher of Chinese movies. Is Mao depicted a lot and often in this way, or like, is what's his position in Chinese sort of, like in pop culture?
I think this one is pretty typical because the actor that plays Mao in this movie, Tang Guoqiang, he's played Mao, oh my gosh, in probably like 10 different movies or so. It's always him. You look at other movies, he plays Mao in almost all of them. So it's a very familiar depiction, I would say.
Think of this, the stakes too, because the historic, for him personally, this war takes his son, right? His son shows up in the movie. Mm-hmm. People in the theater started like, people were like responding. Like they were like, oh, it's him. Like they knew instantly who he was. And like, it was interesting. I was the only non-Chinese Korean person in the movie theater. And like, it just, you know, this was something that was meaningful to them. And like the way that they reacted, like at least a few people in the audience, like had a kind of, you know, like audible reaction to both Mao and his son was really interesting. And I was like, oh, this is like, you know, because I just think of it for me. I'm like this dopey Iranian kid. I grew up in the West. All I know of Mao is like Andy Warhol, Prince. Right, mm-hmm. Like the caricature of the supposed caricature he is in China, right? Of like, oh, cult of personality, like all the stupid things that like imperialists and like Westerners think about China is like, oh, just like this, you know. And then the need to like depict him in this like demeaning way and like commodify him the way that like Warhol did, it's always like bugged me, and it's like bugged me more and more. It's like, that's the only image I had of him. It's just like, is this like, you know, whatever. And so to see him on screen depicted and to have him sort of like, it drew in the, like, this is like a work of historical fiction. The, and in, I mean, obviously that was true before, obviously before that scene, but in doing that, it kind of really implicates the audiences that like, oh, I'm watching history. Now, of course, the fiction part of historical fiction is always to be considered. It is fictionalized, but like the characters, like the sort of cast of characters, even in that room where they're deciding, like Deng Xiaoping is in that room with him. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, and I don't know, for me, I was like excited to actually like, oh wow, I'm actually getting like a representation of Chinese history that isn't by some hack regime changer or, you know, Adrian Zenz or fucking, you know, like, you know what I mean? Or some boring academic who's like specializing in like China 400 years ago. Like this felt, at least to me, a kind of a noob to all of this. Like, oh, like this is like, I'm watching Chinese people imagine their own history, and like, I get to consume it because this is like a popular cultural sort of phenomenon. And I'm, you know, there's no regime changers here to ruin this experience, to mediate it through the, like the typical lens that everything around China gets mediated here.
Yeah. And I think that's, it's a really important scene to kind of set the stakes. Cause as you mentioned, this is 1950. This is just a year after the People's Republic of China was founded. And they said, well, hey, if UN forces cross the 38th parallel to North Korea, they're going to push toward the Yalu River. And, you know, once they get to the Yalu River, who's to say that they're going to stop there, right? And so these are all, like, existential concerns for such a young country. And so they decided, like, hey, we need to do something here if the UN forces are going to keep advancing toward the border.
And in late 1950, MacArthur was dead wrong about the key fact of the Korean War. He believed that the Chinese government would not send the Chinese military into Korea. He assured President Truman of this at a meeting on Wake Island in October 1950. We have the transcript of the meeting. MacArthur later said that was too sneaky to take transcripts of his promises. At that meeting, not only did MacArthur say the Chinese would not intervene, he said if they did, the Chinese would be wiped out by American aircraft. It would be the greatest slaughter, he told the president. But as I will discuss now, that is not what happened.
And another note, like, you know, seeing Deng Xiaoping, seeing Zhu De, Peng Dehuai, all of these famous people from like Chinese revolutionary history, like, there are a lot of movies that I would say are relatively big budget or popular in China, but, you know, didn't really have this international release. And so I'd say, like, this is actually pretty typical, you know, being able to see these characters portrayed by, like, you know, pretty famous actors in China. I'll send, like, a couple of other links to you that you can post with this, because they're all free on YouTube. But there's, like, a movie on the 100 Regiments Offensive from World War II. There's one on, like, the breakout from the Fourth Encirclement during the Chinese, or like before the Long March too. But there are a lot of movies in that period where you get to see, like, hey, that's Deng Xiaoping, that's Liu Shaoqi. These are people that, you know, we recognize from the books and history, right? So yeah, that's I think that's my explanation of why people would react to it, because it's very familiar and it's very, I guess, almost nostalgic, right? Like, hey, these, you know, this is familiar. This is, these are people that, you know, we've always seen in movies, and it's really cool to see them, you know, in this particular context.
Yeah, and totally. And like the aesthetic experience of like a war movie is like universal, right? Like, things blowing up, limbs, like the screams, the cries. But here's the thing, and I can't help but say this over and over again, like, grew up here. All I've known is Hollywood, okay? I don't like war movies, okay? At least I don't think I do. I don't think they're fun. I always hate them. It turns out I don't like American war movies or British war movies, because actually when it's not like imperialists waging wars in other continents, like, it's actually kind of like you get that romantic nationalist feeling. And by no means am I a Chinese person, but like, I'm experiencing that empathetically of like, These dudes are volunteering to protect their homeland from a psycho named Douglas MacArthur and his mercenary brigade, like that has been assaulting the peninsula just south of your country. Like, we clawed our way out of a civil war, a brutal civil war. We lost Taiwan in the process, right? Like just lost like a chunk of our country's identity, whatever, got turned into a different country. And that's when like Taiwan was still recognized as a country, right, or something, or maybe that's later, I don't remember.
Yeah, like, it still is. It's this is like 1950, right? So it's still like 20 some years before the PRC gets its spot on the UN.
Right. So like, so you know, and so like these characters come to you as very natural, organic, and it's like, you know, watching war movies is like, in over where we live, is like, oh, I went to Iraq and I got traumatized. It's like, yeah, you shouldn't have gone to Iraq, dumbass. Like, why did you do that? Why'd you volunteer to be a mercenary for fucking Raytheon? Maybe you shouldn't have done that. Oh, because you were poor? Oh, I'm sorry. Lots of poor people don't do that. Like, I am not going to entertain arguments about, like, oh, the victimhood of American soldiers. Like, no, you're mercenaries. If you have half a brain, you know what you're getting into. But, like, so it's hard to empathize with that, which is why, like, all the more movies we know are, like, World War II movies, where Americans can, at least with an intense degree of plausible deny, like sort of force, can convince themselves that they were the good guys,
mm-hmm.
right? But like, you make a war movie about Iraq war, who's the bad guy in that? Like, who's gonna identify? Of course they do anyways, like they do make their dumb war movies, but they usually have to be isolated incidents of like, oh, 12 heroic Marines escaping on horseback from the fucking mountains of blah blah. So, shut up. Like, that's, it's not like exciting. It's not like, I don't know, not to me. I mean, I'm sure it is for tens of millions of fucking rubes out there.
Yeah.
But it was such a relief to like enjoy this movie of like, good. Yeah. Like watching American soldiers get blown up and like stabbed in the neck and stuff. And like the stuff that's like usually relegated to our enemies here. Right. Like this, like you get to see it in reverse and sort of operate in this sort of alternative theater space. And for me, it was great. I mean, the other thing I noticed too was that the stilted speech of the Americans, not just in this movie, but the other movie you recommended, My War, because it's like, oh, so that's how like Chinese people hear Americans when they speak English? It's like they talk like they're in like, it's just like this very awkward, and it's like a reminder that like people hear what they hear when it, like, they don't understand it, mm-hmm. you know, and like that might be how we, like, imagine how our depictions of them are to them now, like how silly these Americans look in like the few scenes. I mean, I did love the fact that they made MacArthur look like this leprous psycho, like with like potch, like whatever, like all these like liver spots. Like, it did not make him look in a good light.
Yeah,
and I did not know about his bloodthirstiness at all before this last week and a half.
You know, but do you think that came across in the movie? I feel like in the movie, you know, like visually aside, they didn't really portray him as that bloodthirsty. At most, he was portrayed as like really overconfident, right? But they, you know, they could have been much harsher on MacArthur, and I don't think they really did.
It's interesting, is that like that, like it's that wasn't the pro, like they could have easily done that. Yeah, it's exactly right. Like, they could have easily done that, and they didn't. And instead, you know, the other general comes off pretty OP Smith, who has been kind of vindicated by history for his actions at the place. I swear to God, the people who wrote this movie also watched the same YouTube lecture I watched, because it was by this, you know, this sort of quasi-official kind of guy, Thomas Ricks. He's like the military historian, one of these military historian guys. He writes a lot about like military history, and he has this lecture that has like a lot of views on YouTube, and he outlines why this character, O.P. Smith, in the movie is so, like, saved 15,000 Marines. Like, they there are some spots where, like, the staggering amounts of losses for the American soldiers, like, are clear in this. And you don't get that from this movie. It's really not about Americans. The Americans are just whatever. Like, it's not, it's clear that, like, the directors of this movie were like, this is a story about Chinese soldiers fighting a just war against imperialists. Like, we'll, you know, we we're not interested in like making this crazy complicated thing with the enemy and stuff. And I mean, I love the way the soldiers talk to each other. It was pretty funny too, because it was like totally unnatural and everything. But I did wonder about how these like the characters themselves, and this is kind of like true with a lot of war movies, is that they represent the nation, you know, in like a way that they're pulled from different parts of the country that, you know, that they bring together in these units. And like, it's a common thing. Like, I'm thinking of like the scene in Forrest Gump where he's like introducing all the characters. He's like, oh, that's Dallas, he's from Georgia or whatever. And like, the part of a war movie is to help solidify the idea of like the national identity, right? That like, we have this strong, solid Chinese identity, and it's coming together in this people's, in this volunteer army, right? And we're going to defend our country. I mean, I'm sitting here gushing over this movie, but I was thinking too, is that like,